Okay, so there, Avnit. Yay. Oh, she might have. She sent me a mail. Pretty slow. No, I don't have a cam for now, but you'll be able to see Peter. So I'm going to start by, just for everybody, we're going to start by watching this video that of the Rachel Brown intervention at the Brookline event. Avnit, you can find the video on the Rachel for Congress. Okay, you might have seen it. Yeah. All right, sweet. So we're just going to start with that. It's about 15 minutes. I might cut it, but I explain why this is important as a tool for us to organize. Most people here have done some organizing, so make it bigger. Okay.
Hi.
Whoops.
Oh, Vimeo videos don't seem to play when they get streamlined on the computer. It happened last time too.
Okay, well, let's skip them. Well, who hasn't seen it? Who hasn't seen that video? You saw? Oh yeah, you saw. You guys were talking about it. Okay, so we have problems here, so we're not gonna show it. But
you can download it and you can show it in 5 minutes.
Okay, just escape. Okay, well, let's start with the briefing. I'll go back to that. We'll talk about it, but whoever hasn't seen it should take a look because it talks for itself. So Mr. LaRouche is now in Germany. He's been in Germany for a couple of days now. In order to not do some sightseeing, although maybe he does, but the main reason why he's here is to make a proposal to the Germans, including in German institutions, people in the German government, around what we know and what most people know as what's called the Glass-Steagall policy proposal. We've been defending that policy for a while now. It has to pass. It has to be passed in the United States in order for this policy to really spread around afterwards. And Monsieur LaRouche, being in Germany, has made that proposal saying, join me in this fight. Let's get this Glass-Steagall pass. And let's get whatever else you guys have which resembles Glass-Steagall. Let's bring that back. Or let's make a Glass-Steagall legislation in Germany, France, Canada. I'm going to talk a bit about Canada and that, and the Glass-Steagall too. We've got some a beginning of some intelligence regarding that. And so Mr. LaRouche, by doing that proposal, is not simply making a proposal for technicality. As he said in one of his discussion, which is on the website, we have to make clear to people what imperialism is, that we're not dealing with a nation that go berserk by, you know, growth of its own power. Or imperialism is not the end of any nation. Nations don't grow into empire. It's more like a blob that takes on the nation and actually drags the nations away from its responsibility, which is to develop its people, and drives it towards destruction, and brings back those old ideas that, you know, some queen or some king has to rule because they have a blue blood or they represent I don't know what entity. But and to break away from the Republican idea of mankind. So we have to explain that clearly so that nations like Germany, for example, has to understand what's going on in the United States. It's easy for people outside, like here, to say, okay, United States, empire that will collapse, period. Let's turn with the Chinese. Right, we hear that a lot. You know, let's go towards a new pole. Like the United States is going to collapse, that's for sure. Well, it's not, and hopefully it's not. Otherwise, we're all screwed. And so we got to make clear this idea of imperialism and how it acts in Europe or acts in Russia or other places so that these people can identify the problem and actually go with the solution. And when we say last eagle, as I said, we're not just talking about a technical matter. We're talking about a policy that frightened and pissed off the imperialist, British imperialist networks who actually saw the implementation of the U.S. Constitution in form of a law, Glass-Steagall, and which actually prevented a very important part of the British Empire, which is the financial part, prevented that part from being active in an imperialist manner. So they had to take, as we say in French, they had to take their hole. Anyway, but they had
How do you say that in French?
Il faut que l'empire prenne son trou. Like, go in your hole and stay there, you know. Yeah, I'm teaching French here at the same time. So, but no, that they had to behave, pretty much. Whether you behave as an empire, or whether you behave as a human being, and you drop that imperialist bullshit, don't touch our financial system, don't touch our economy, and, you know, we might give you a nice house and a nice meal. Okay. And I'm saying that because what we see in the United States right now, we're seeing not simply a reaction to an event, right? As LaRouche has been stressing a lot, we're not dealing with events that trigger policies or trigger a change in the population, but there's a bigger dynamic. It's actually a revival of a dynamic that's been dormant for many generations in the United States. This dynamic of a society that fights imperialism. The United States have a very big history of that. They did it for many times. They had many victories against them. And this sentiment is coming back in the context of a financial collapse, BP, all these different events that brings the mind closer towards where the real problem lies. And this anti-imperialist British dynamic has been the dynamic for a very long time now. So what we're seeing, for example, one of our representatives, John Offal, in the last discussion with Mr. LaRouche, said that he hypothesized that the BP crime was actually in response to the failure of the Copenhagen summit on the environmentalist policies. And LaRouche says, no, forget about that. This is this dynamic of the British fighting the United States has been going on for many, many generations since the Declaration of Independence or before. So let's not try to put little factoids together, but you gotta look at the whole picture. And nations, people like in Canada, also have to find themselves in that picture, so that we actually take part of the right dynamic instead of being caught with some idea that, you hear that in the street, like Europe is better, people are smarter in Europe, the United States is going to collapse, or, you know, Obama is the best. There's a lot of those facts, so we have to really emphasize to people that idea of the dynamic. And this idea also of the mass strike, which is the consequence of that there's a motion towards not simply against the government, the people are not just against the government, but they're also and more against the Wall Street crowd. And we see this with Blanche Lincoln legislation, what she's been proposing as a ban on derivatives, which is a powerful legislation against that crowd. And it's a legislation that have popular support because she just got reelected was that primaries or was it the Congress? Primaries, Democratic primaries. And
meaning that she will be the Democratic choice for her riding.
Yeah, she just won, and she also had to deal with the Democratic Party being against actually defending another candidate than her. So she actually got the support to fight the Democratic machine, the Democratic hacks, as they call it. And not only that, but she also got the support from two presidents of Federal Reserves in the United States, Kansas and St. Louis. That's important. That means that, I guess, people that are away from New York and the D.C. can think a bit better, and they have a sense that in order to control that system that we have, you need that sort of control on derivatives, like a ban. A ban, which is a pretty good control. So with that said, we're going to have... I'm going to go through some details, but there's going to be a video made soon on this question of the Glass-Steagall and the fight to stop it. We've been emphasizing the 1999 repeal of Glass-Steagall, but it started before. And it was not only a fight to stop the Glass-Steagall around 1984, but it also happened in other countries. I'm going to go into that a bit. So, PowerPoint. Which could be useful. Okay, so in 1984. So, oops. If some of you are... right, people remember Alan Greenspan or have a sense of who he was, former chairman of the Fed. But at the time, director at J.P. Morgan in the United States. And with this other guy, William Dudley, former asset of J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, and helped write the paper, which was called, no, I forget the name, was that Rethinking? Yeah, that was Rethinking Glass-Steagall. And who is now, he was one of the author and the editors. He is now the CEO of the New York Federal Reserve since Obama is in the White House. And these people said, like we've heard many times, that when you have a financial problem, they say, well, let's liberalize the whole thing. Let's give banks access to however liquidity they might need. And the Glass-Steagall prevents that. Glass-Steagall prevents, creative ways of making money. And at that time, in 1984, that paper was made. So there was a gradual push to get away from the protection of the Glass-Steagall. And as an example, in the 1990s already, still with the Glass-Steagall, you had commercial banks that were allowed to risk 25% of what they had in speculation, which they weren't able to do before. Today, since 1999, obviously it's much bigger. It's everything. There's no legislation anymore, really. And something, obviously, it wasn't just the United States, but something a bit later happened in Great Britain and Canada. I'm just going to go quickly about that, but it's important because we're dealing with the world dynamic, right? So what happens is that in 1986, there was a success during the Margaret Thatcher government to also break away, get rid of legislations that were dividing the banking activities in order to protect the population. That was called the British Big Bang. Because it was a big bang. Then banks started to go wild. And today you can find on the internet some articles of people regretting that move. Obviously because of the situation we're in.
What years? This would have been around
86. It was after. And after that, same thing happened in Canada too. Where we, at the time, we had what's called the four pillars approach, where banks were divided into four. You had commercial banks, you had trust funds, brokerage firm, and insurance company. All that was divided, you do your thing, don't risk people's money. And what happens is that in 85, two Canadian banks went under. The Canadian Commercial Bank and the Northern Bank, both from the West. I don't have all the details of how they went down, but the Northern Bank did go down from what the experts are saying because they try to just suck up too much money. Mm-hmm. So the main offers of interest rates, for example, you know, buyer bonds or other stuff, and you're going to get that amount, and they couldn't afford it, so they went bust. So this bank failed, and the other two failed, both in 85. And what happened afterwards is that the big six, big Canadian banks, which I think is, I don't want to name them, but you have Bank of Montreal, National Bank, Royal Bank of Canada, Scotia, and CIBC. And then there's another one.
Toronto.
Toronto Dominion. Yeah, Toronto. And Toronto Dominion was actually the leader of the Big Six when they had a meeting, an emergency meeting in Quebec with the Minister of Finance at the time, or the Deputy, the Deputy Finance Minister at the time. And they said, look, if you don't change the rules, Big Six might go under too. Do you want that to happen? So he said no. No one that to happen. So they said, just like we hear, like we heard in 84, saying, allow us to touch to as many things as possible. Allow us to put our hands on commercial banks, insurance, all that stuff, so that we can better regulate our gambling compulsions. And what happened is that not everything was destroyed, but almost. And today it is completely destroyed. But they managed to start gradually the destruction of the four-pillar approach. Now, what's interesting in the article...
Of the four-pillar approach?
Yeah, like this four division. The first thing they did is that they put three of them together. Everything was together except insurance bank. So like you could start speculating on with commercial banks. But there were still some little details of some... I guess, little legislation that didn't allow for the same things that were happening in the U.S. with the repeal of the Glass-Steagall. So you have articles of people saying, Canada missed 20 years of potential for, you know, like, beautiful speculation, innovative competition, stuff like that. And, so they got rid of the four pillars. And one of the articles I've read, which was from this guy Stanley Hart, was a deputy finance minister at the time. And deputy finance minister. And he directly identifies, he basically says, we have to get rid of the, quote, Glass-Steagall mentality. So the Glass-Steagall of 34 allowed other nations as well to go with the same type of legislation. Just like today, if the United States decide to go with the Glass-Steagall, you can quickly have a change, very quick change, in the prospect for development, and also the prospect for really putting an end to that crazy financial system. So, and we're going to get more to that because there's going to be the video by the United States, and we can get a clearer picture of what happened exactly in the. I think the legislation was, it was around 86, 87 that they get rid of the four-pillar approach. But, right, you see an international approach or an international attempt to deregulate. And if you attack the Glass-Steagall, then all the other nations become much more vulnerable. Right? That's what happened in the 80s, at least. Okay. And also Glass-Steagall is the legislation that can protect people against against imperialism and against fascism. So I'm just going to show you this, but if you look, if we look at what's going on with our European friends, okay, okay, that was a while ago in 71. You have LaRouche with the pipe, smoking bubbles, and you have Abba Lerner. And basically what happened in the debate is that Abba Lerner was forced to say something a bit weird coming from a teacher, supposedly a liberal teacher and a very nice guy. We said that if Germany, I'll just read that, says, if the fascist policies of London's Nazi banker, Hjalmar Schacht, had only been adopted willingly by Germany, then, quote, Hitler would not have been necessary. So we don't need a dictator if you agree to put on yourself the fascist policies. Okay. So we have the choice. Whether you choose yourself, it's okay, we'll take the policies, okay. Or you refuse them and you get a dictator, which is a nice choice. And there's a guy in Europe today, José Manuel Durão Barroso, president of the European Commission, who, and that was reported to us, but, and this is not the first time we hear stuff like that from Europe. If you remember, former Prime Minister Balladur from France also made these sorts of quotes. And I'll just read what it says there. That was reported in a British magazine, I forgot. It said, London Economist. And so Mr. Barroso giving a picture of what's in the wait in the waiting room for Europe. So he says, look, if they do not carry out these austerity packages, these countries could virtually disappear in the way that we know them as democracies. They've got no choice. This is it. And then there's an addition by Monk, the guy who reported. He says, he added that Barroso's apocalyptic vision meant that, quote, we're heading back to the 1930s, the Great Depression, and we ended up with militarist dictatorship. So France, Germany, Greece, Spain, better choose. You get the dictator, and then you get the fascist policies, or you get the fascist policies right away. Pick your choice. Yeah, you know, we're a fascist democracy. Could happen. So, and LaRouche responded to that. He says, that's crap. That's crap, crap, crap. That's bullshit. Of course you have a choice. You don't have... of course you have a choice. Reorganize those banks. And the... you know, and what LaRouche was talking about at the early stage of the European crisis, he says, better watch Spain, never mind Greece. Spain is going to blow. And there it is, much bigger. And they're also where you have Banco Santander, which is this British apparatus of banks, which is going under. And they're trying to bail out that thing. So what's occurring now is that you have the IMF, the European Union, and the United States Department, State Department, the U.S. Financial Treasury Department, who are actually trying to create a bailout for Spain of about $300 billion. So they're going around the clock, you know, calling their banker friend, you know, you got a couple.
Do they like, have one of those thermometers where they've got, like, the
probably
marked off and, like, it gets redder and redder, and it's like, oh, we're at, you know, $120 billion now.
That's probably what's going on because it's They're freaking out. These guys are not in control. And we know that we had France and Germany who, over the recent weeks, showed some guts by putting by making proposals to ban derivatives or to not bail out derivatives, which is not super great, but which is already better. But this is dying out. So it's also a reason why Mr. Roush has to go over there and explain really what the situation in the U.S. and with this Glass-Steagall. If the Glass-Steagall pass, then we create the right type of situation for the rest of the world. And anyway, it's not that big of a deal if the euro collapsed because it is actually a British concoction. And if you go on our French website, you see an article on the subject. I'm just gonna This just came out, whoops. But the people that created and promoted the Euro system, the European Union, the Maastricht Treaty, and all the treaties that goes with it, actually comes from this guy, Francis Arthur Cockfield, Baron Francis, etc. Worked in Great Britain under Thatcher, Privy Council, and also worked with French President Jacques Delors in the 80s and I guess probably 90s too. And most people, if you ask them about the euro, they'll say, "Oh, it's Delors who created it." But recently, or not recently, but when Cockfield died, and that was written in the Independent, so it's a London newspaper. They're just two quotes, but it goes more in length as to what was the role of that guy behind the law and how actually Cockfield really pushed the white paper called Europe 1992, so the white paper for the project. And here are two quotes from him. It was the speed at which I produced the white book which allowed us to take everybody by surprise. So you might want to wonder why we want to take people by surprise. And then it says, that he wrote the document, and he says, to give time for heads of state to skim through the document and appreciate the great occasion they have without leaving enough time for high government officials to shred it into pieces. And you have obviously a series of papers that were done by this guy to actually, as we've seen recently, to really rush through a policy. Right? Here's our policy at 2,000 pages, you know, vote on it tomorrow. And you avoid a real debate. So the euro system was really imposed on the European unions. And it's important to know, the article is pretty good, but it's important to know that because a lot of people will say that the European Union was just grew out of the people. It was like this beautiful, organic idea that everybody agreed. And it was like, people were floated. Towards
when you work from the grassroots.
Yeah, so it wasn't grassroots at all. We also saw it with the different votes they had over the years. It's just not a popular idea. Okay, all right, I'm on time. All right, and just finishing on the British. People heard there was a speech given by Mr. Obama. So the policy of the imperial British policy of destroying the United States for Obama, I mean, thanks to Obama, has now been replaced by another British policy to destroy not just the United States, but the whole world. He says about BP and the whole thing, he says, "We can't afford not to change how we produce and use energy by finally putting a price on carbon pollution." And if you guys have seen a bit what we've published, but we've shown that this whole cap and trade thing is pretty much another financial gimmick, which actually forces a taxation on companies that can't even stand the economic situation now anyway. So you have this carbon tax to supposedly help, but actually destroys your industry. Instead of really going for, as we talk, the nuclear option. And we've published different things about that because, first on the BP thing, I think there's a couple of facts which are important to understand really what's going on and why we're saying that, you know, what Obama is doing is really treason. The one I like the most is that, I think it's pretty important, but he already had, since the spill, 17 nations offered their help already to deal with the mess. Only four have been allowed to. And the reason why they say, well, because we want BP to pay for all this. But BP is just saying, fuck you. So they're basically preventing those nations from coming to help. Which is already a big problem. The other thing, which is has to do with the NOA, or the NOAA, which is, I wrote it down. National
Oceanic
and Atmospheric Association. People who made a quick assessment of the situation. So already in the first week, they knew what was going on. They knew how much barrels were being coming out of the well. And the White House actually asked the NOA to just keep it down, to actually not say what they had to say, and to go with the BP approach, saying, you know, let's go so slowly that things are just going to be completely screwed up in a couple of weeks. And was there another thing? Oh yeah, the other thing, which has to do with the nuclear, because the way we've approached this is that in order to solve the problem, two ways, we're going to need nuclear. The first is, people might not like it, but we need a peaceful nuclear explosion somewhere near the well. I'm not just going crazy. It's actually a technology that does exist, that in order to close the well, when you need a motion of the horizontal layers of the ground on the bottom to be able to move fast and enough, you need enough to move to really cover the well at the lower basis where the breaking point is. This is stuff that was done by the Russian. They're five out of five or six out of six.
Five out of six.
And
How deep?
It's a deep well in general. I think it's 18,000 feet. That's deeper than most wells. But the idea is that, the situation is just getting crazy. Mm-hmm. So you really have to shut that down fast.
Do you mean the Russians have done it on similar catastrophes that happened
yeah.
in their territory?
Yeah. Okay. No, they didn't try in the Gulf of Mexico, but they tried their own thing. So that's the first thing. We can talk about it afterwards, but in order to solve the problem very fast, you need that type of action. But also, if you take it on the bigger, a little bigger picture, the fact that a company has to go that far off the shore and so deep to get some oil is not just counterproductive, but can also be considered as stupid. And if you have a society driven towards nuclear, like also nuclear fusion. And as we've discussed before, you're not just dealing with a higher density of energy with very little material, like a uranium, but you're also you're actually going towards a society that can produce their own isotopes. That's a key thing. So that you don't have to go, you know, under 5 billion... You don't have to go inside the Earth nucleus, you know, to get some energy or something like that. You can actually produce it by yourself and not have to. I mean, it was a risky operation in a sense. It wasn't the this DP well was the deepest they had ever done. And you know, accident happens and BP is just screwing things up. But the nuclear economy is going to be the way to go in order to have real natural resources that we can produce ourselves and avoid these sorts of risks which are useless. So yeah, there's another good article on that on the website. So I would say, maybe as to conclude, yeah, there's other things about Afghanistan, but we can talk about it some other time. All this stuff we've been talking about, especially at the beginning, right, when we talk about the dynamic, should be discussing about that again. But this is the kind of ideas that we have to bring out in the street and really organize people so they can really understand what dynamic they're in, what is it exactly they're fighting, so that they can actually do something. That's our role. And LaRouche is going to give a speech on the 26th in order to actually get people on the bandwagon, to really give a strategic overview and answer questions from the institutions as well. So we better get as many people as possible to listen to that, you know, whatever, Saint Jean-Baptiste weekend or not. Drinking beer is not going to help. It doesn't make you a better patriot. I don't think so. Even if it's very good beer, it's not going to do it. So I'll leave it at that. And just maybe also, we haven't watched it, but later people should watch the Rachel Brown Barney Frank exchange by itself. You know, just watch it and let's talk about it afterwards. So that's it for me. Do you have any questions?
The speech that you took this quote here from Obama.
Oh, yeah.
Was that, when was that?
Tuesday night.
Tuesday? The last one he did in the, well, the one he did in the Oval Office.
So he's taking an opportunity to address the nation, and he's talking about carbon taxing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is another British imperial proposal.
It's a little off topic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you would expect, because he starts well, and he says, oh, we're going to think about how we produce and create energy. Okay, sure. Let's talk about nuclear or dams or something. No, let's put a tax on companies. Put a tax on industries. Well, I'm still going to need BP. And if we don't fight these guys, then you know, it's not, these things are not going to change.
Mm-hmm. Plus, that after that speech, the day after, all the medias were big time, like,
mm-hmm.
talking about the fact that he was meeting with the BP CEO. Like, or the board